Shalom and welcome to Nourish Your Biblical Roots Conversations with Yael. I'm your host, Yael Eckstein, President and CEO of the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews. When my father, Rabbi Chil Eckstein of blessed memory, founded the fellowship, his goal was to build bridges of faith between Christians and Jews, between the people of Israel and the world. And so I am always inspired when I'm able to befriend and talk with a fellow bridge builder. Today's guest is someone I have known for many years. We were just reminiscing how I was hosted on his podcast over 10 years ago, and he is a true bridge builder. Dumisani Washington is a husband, a father, a pastor, a professional musician, the founder and CEO of the Institute for Black Solidarity with Israel, and the author of Zionism and the Black Church, Why Standing with Israel Will Be a Defining Issue for Christians of Color in the 21st Century. And along with all of these accomplishments, Pastor Washington is a friend of Israel and a friend of mine. In these troubled times in the Holy Land and for the Jewish people around the world, we need and appreciate faithful friends and builders of bridges of faith, of friendship, and of fellowship just like him. So, Pastor Washington, thank you so much for joining me today on the podcast and welcome.
Yael, I'm honored to be with you again for the first time in a little while. Other than emails and things like that, we actually have an interview conversation. And again, as I was saying, I can't believe it was 10 years. And please let me also say, I know it's been a couple of years, but we have been praying for you and your family in the passing of your wonderful father. When I saw that announcement, my wife and I were very, our hearts were just struck, right? So, but we've been praying and you've been doing an amazing job. We've just been watching with the fellowship. So thank you so much for what you do.
Oh, thank you. I was just saying how you're someone who has such a unique voice, such a unique perspective, and such a unique mission. And everywhere I go, I hear people talking about how much they appreciate what you're doing, including my husband, who we very rarely talk about work. And the other day, he said to me out of nowhere, "Do you by chance know Dumisani Washington?" I'm like, "I've known him forever. He really is as amazing as he seems." So he said, "Please tell him that I follow him, that I love what he does." And so you have such a big admiring crowd here in Israel and across the world for what you do. So let's start a little bit how you developed this unique voice. You were born in Little Rock, Arkansas, but raised in California. So I'd love to hear a little bit about your upbringing, your family's history, and how that shaped you as well as your faith.
Yes, ma'am. So I'm born, February 17th, 1967, what was still segregated South, Little Rock, Arkansas. Our family were members of King Solomon Baptist Church. They're very faithful members. My dad, a singer and a deacon member, and my mom worked with the youth and all those things. So we were church babies. We were there all the time. But I don't have any memory of it directly because we moved when I was a baby, right? So they continued to be very much involved in church when we did move to California, but we moved to San Francisco around 1968. My mom's sisters and my dad's siblings, there's like a lot of mass migration from Black families in the South going to whether the Midwest or the West Coast and obviously to New York. And we were part of that wave that went to San Francisco, went to the Bay Area. And I grew up first there. After about 5 years, my father's job moved from the Bay Area to the Valley, which is Stockton. For those of you who ever watched Big Valley back in the day on television, that was based there in Stockton in Sacramento, California. We moved there. And ironically, among many other things, we moved there, Yael, the summer of 1972, which is where I met who would become my wife. I met my wife, Valerie. She wasn't my wife then. We were both 5 years old, but I met her then. They lived a few blocks away from us. And so we kind of grew up together, went to churches together and school for a little while together and everything. So yeah, that was my formative time. And my mom, more so than my father, we talked about it on both ends, but she would talk about her life in Little Rock and her upbringing. We talked about segregation, we talked about Jim Crow, but it was, I wouldn't say unique. Yael, the conversation was never around victimization, how we were discriminated against. Hers was always a celebration of the community. She graduated from Scipio A. Jones High School, right? It was all Black high school by force, right? Because just like our Jewish friends, we were segregated, right? We were put over here, right? So, but the school was, I mean, all Black teachers, administrators, everything, right? So on the one hand, here's this segregation that is oppressive because it's done by race. It's not allowing you to do X, Y, and Z. But on the other hand, here are these Black students and leaders who are distinguishing themselves, who are still accomplishing regardless of the things that are around them. So there's always that dual thing that was happening. So because of that, I grew up very proud of that heritage, not in a haughty sense, but in a very much, as I said in some of my writings, I descended from superheroes. I recognized what they had gone through and what they accomplished. And as I got older and older, I realized that it was pretty remarkable what they were able to do. So yeah, that was part of my upbringing.
I love that so much. And there's so much about that, first of all, that's very similar to my upbringing. My family, actually, when they left Israel in 1929, after 11 generations in Jerusalem, they went straight to Little Rock, Arkansas. So we have those roots that are very shared. And my father also was a musician that I want to hear in a minute about what led you to be a professional musician, what that means to you in your life today. But I love how your parents, in their wisdom, strength, and it sounds like faith that is unshakable and unbreakable, that they were able through that to look at something that caused you a lot of hardship, that caused you a lot of pain, to actually transform it into a strength and give you an identity that you are so proud of from a place that it only makes you better, stronger, and more convicted in what you're able to do in this world. In what way do you think that today we see a lot of victimization, I think, for every group and every people in a different way. In what way do you think that we could turn that around to strengthen this generation and empower them instead of weaken them? And is that what you see happening?
I think that the most important way that happens is really education information, right? So that there is the telling of the story in its fullness, right? What we call the good, the bad, and the ugly. So that the person, and now I mean, especially if it's a younger generation, right? I love that scripture in Psalm, one generation shall declare your works to another, right? So there is this passing down from generation to generation. I think that the most effective way, in my opinion, in taking even tragedies and turning them into triumphs is for that individual to learn that it has been done, not that it's just possible, right? But that there are those who came before that person who faced all kinds of diverse difficulties, tragedies, all those things, but then still moved forward, built, right? And that they, now the younger person, represent the legacy of those people who not only did not give up, but brought them here, that if it wasn't for them, right, then they wouldn't be here. So that's, to me, the ultimate evidence of having moved forward, right? Your progeny, your life, your legacy, what you're able to give. And I think that if it's done in that way, right, one of the things that we do in our organization a lot, yeah, we deal with education, both K through 12 and also on the college level. And we say often that if the instructor has not been able to synthesize all that information. In other words, if they're taking even difficult stories, but they're only using it to victimize their students, it's a very poisonous thing, right? Because I can be giving as an instructor, if I'm using myself as an example, I can give these students all kinds of bad examples of horrific things that have happened. Ethnic groups, what happened to the Japanese during World War II? What happened to our Jewish brothers? And I can say those things in a way that doesn't give those students the whole picture that, yes, these things happen, but these are the things that were built as a result of this, how these people moved forward. I think that to me is the most effective way. How do I keep it from becoming victimization? Not so much by denying what happened, but by embracing that and saying, yes, but they were able to do these things afterwards.
Wow, the resilience.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Incredible. So that goes a lot, I think, also to your music. I know that my own father, Rabbi Chiel Eckstein, was also a musician. And as a young man, he traveled to Israel from America during the Yom Kippur War in 1973, I believe, to perform for the troops and the wounded IDF soldiers. And it's something that gave him a lot of strength. And in the early days of the fellowship, he helped support our family by working as a wedding singer. So you have an incredible group called The Hebrew Project, which combines gospel music and Hebrew lyrics. Tell me more about that, about your love for music and how you use it through everything that you're saying, really to educate both on the hardships of the past, but the resilience that's possible based on figures that have done it, that have overcome their hardships to build something beautiful. How does that get through in your music?
That was my first love in that sense as a young child. So I began playing the piano at a young age. There would be a piano in the house, my aunt's house, our house. And so I began to play. Again, we were so involved in church. I eventually started playing in church, playing for the choir, playing for Sunday school. And so that was always meshed together. My whole church experience was always wrapped in music because I had been playing from the time I was in grade school, right? And all the way through high school and college and everything. I would write. I loved to write, but it was always an organic thing. It was just songs would, like, they would come, music would come, right? And at some point, Yael, and
it's
this
like
was
prophecy, it sounds like, even Dumisani.
It was in my time of meditation or thinking and contemplating or just singing and worship, there I'd be doing it, you know, kind of spontaneously, and then music would come from there, right? As many musicians know, right? Because it's just an organic process, right? It's clearly just God just kind of dropping something in your spirit, right? And right in that way, it was later on in my life, probably in the 90s, when I began to become very much fascinated with exploring the Jewish roots of my faith, right? Wanting to know more about this Jesus, wanting to know more about this Jerusalem, those type of thing, and having some Jewish friends and having from them learning some of the songs in their Siddur, learning the Kaddosh, learning the Shema. And after a while, just again, naturally, those things started to fuse. So my gospel / jazz roots would fuse with some of the music that I was hearing. That was, sometimes it was klezmer, sometimes it was different styles in terms of the Jewish parts of it, but then they would fuse, right? So these gospel versions of Kaddosh, these gospel versions of Micha Mocha, it was never contrived. I didn't sit down in the room and, you know, okay, let me write a gospel version of X, right? It started just happening. And so after a while, I started teaching them either to our worship team or whatever. And the Hebrew Project artists later on became a full-fledged, let's do this as a group. We recorded some of the songs and everything. So just over a period of time, it became that the group, even though now I'm in North Carolina now, most of the group is in California, but we still from time to time come together, either recording something or we'll do a performance somewhere and everything. So that's kind of how that got started.
Incredible. Incredible. I love it because I think for anyone who's heard it, it really does feel like God singing through you. It's a bridge of so much inspiration and spirituality and beauty. And I think it's the practical words to make me a temple and I will dwell within, that when I hear that, I just hear God's words coming through, that you've created a vessel. It's so beautiful. And it goes back a lot of what you're talking about to your very early love and support and wanting to learn more about what you call in your book, intrigued by all things Israelite. So I know that the Old Testament fascinated and shaped you in a deep way. What's your earliest memory from there? Was that given over by your parents? And how has that shaped your path?
What I love about the way our parents did with all of us, I'm the youngest of seven, right? So it was for all of us. They would buy us Bibles when we were little kids and everything. And we went to church all the time. And we were very, you know, we went to church and we participated in everything, but they weren't overbearing, Yael, in the sense that they were not these oppressive religious people in the sense that somehow, you know, we made a mistake. It wasn't like that.
It was love.
Yes, it was. It really was. So when they bought us Bibles, they didn't give us Bibles and say, hey, you read this many chapters every day, or I'm going to, it was nothing like, they said here, and we'd be in Sunday school or whatever. And so we would read, right? And all of my siblings, we all took different paths, right, in terms of our lives. But our parents gave us that foundation, right? So I began reading, and I don't know, 7, 8 years old, around that time, I would read, and I only knew this in retrospect. I didn't know it in real time, right? Because I didn't know, I knew there was an Old and New Testament, but I didn't know what that meant. I'm a kid, right? So it's a book, right, that has these different things in it. So I'm reading, and I would read the Old Testament or the Tanakh, right? much more than the New Testament. Now, I love reading. I read the Gospels and the miracles of Jesus and everything, and that those things fascinated me as well. It wasn't in any way a turning from it, but I was more intrigued with Joseph and his brothers and David and Goliath, David and Saul. And so by the time I'm probably in middle school, I probably read these stories, albeit in the English, right? Not in the Hebrew, but over and over and over again, so that I'm memorizing certain sections of it, not knowing that that's what I'm doing, right? I'm visualizing it, I'm seeing it, and didn't really know. And what one of the things I appreciate about my parents is that they saw it, right? They weren't really, for all the parents there who had multiple kids, by the time you get to child number 5, 6, 7, you're not as watching over as child 1, 2, and 3. And for the parents, if you do, those who had kids, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. That doesn't mean you don't have your kids. It just means that your style and the community kind of changes and shapes and everything. And so I'm doing what I'm doing, but Yael, at no point when they saw that they ever say, hey, why are you reading Exodus, right? Again, it was never a situation where, no, you read the New Testament, you don't read the Old Testament. So there was never a stigma in that. Not to mention the fact that in the historic Black church tradition, and as you probably know this, Yael, I always try to be careful when I'm saying that. I'm not trying to segregate it and make it a race thing, like, oh, there's a Black church, there's a white church. But I'm trying to speak in terms of a historical heritage, if you will, some sort of lineage that's there. In that historic Black church tradition, Old Testament preaching was very much a norm, right? It's not as much as it is today, right? But this whole allusion to the children of Israel and Moses and the redemption being the slave past and all those types of things, this was always the case, but not even just with slavery, the Negro spirituals. Most of them set in the Old Testament, some set in the New Testament, but Joshua at the Battle of Jericho, Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, of course, go down Moses and on, most of Elijah Rock, right? You know, did my Lord deliver Daniel? These are Negro spirituals set, and they're talking about either the patriarchs or these heroes of the Bible, particularly in the Old Testament, with a faith that the way that God delivered them, he would deliver us when what we were actually going through here in the States, in the New World. So for me, reading it, I didn't understand at the time either. There was this love for the spirituals, which got connected later on. It's like, oh, okay, well, many of those spirituals are said in this Old Testament that I keep reading, right? Of the spirituals, and this is like over several years, right? I grew up, I call the granddaddy of all the spirituals, Lift Every Voice and Sing, right? James Weldon Johnson.
Yes.
It was a poem, became a song, a poem in 1899. But what's amazing, Yael, is that in that song, among many of, it's a very Zionist song. And in that last stanza, Yael, James Weldon Johnson uses a phrase, lest our feet stray from the places our God where we met thee, lest our hearts drunk with the wine of the world, we forget thee, which is a direct reference to Jeremiah 51, being drunk with the wine of Babylon, right? It's to come out of Babylon. It's actually saying that. So here are our leaders at the turn of the century saying to Black Americans who are now not even 40, 50 years removed from slavery, right? This is 1899. That we are to remember the God who brought us out. And it's a prayer to God to help us remember you, right? Like what Moses says to the children of Israel, when you get to the land, don't forget, right? And then he says, God, we need you to help us to remember you, lest our feet stray from this place and lest our hearts get drunk with the wine of the world, and lest our love for the world and all things worldly keeps our love from you, for you, growing, right? And so I know I've gone off on a tangent. I apologize for that. But that was part of it, Yael. So for me, reading, and it was heritage, right? Not even knowing it, right? I'm walking in at heritage, but I'm a little kid, so I don't really know it. I look back and I go, oh, okay, I understand some of what was going on at the time.
That's incredible how even as a child, you found inspiration in God's words in ways that weren't necessarily so direct, but you realized they were relevant to you. They were inspirational to you, and you've taken that with you forever. So yeah. I could imagine then the first time you went to Israel, that must have been an experience of a lifetime. Tell me about that you got to walk the places that you just spoke about, where King David stood, where the temple stood, to go where Saul walked and where Jesus walked, where the disciples walked. What was that like for you? And what are some, when you think about your first trip to Israel, there are some memories and there are some feelings. Describe those to me.
It was overwhelming at times, because again, it was my first time, 2012, December 2012, right around Hanukkah. Of the many things, yes, Sea of Galilee, going to the Garden Tomb, going to City of David, Hezekiah, the tunnels, kind of do all these, just fascinating, right? Yael, among the many things that I experienced, it was at the Kotel, at the Western Wall. The first day we went, I guess we had come down from the Galil and, you know, did the bus thing, and there's a way that they do it. And the closer we got, so we're driving, you know, the route very well, and you can see Jerusalem in the distance, right? The closer we got, the more intense it became for me. By the time we got to the Kotel, and our tour guide is leading us, you know, through the way, kind of go through the gate part, and I was overwhelmed. I couldn't go, right? So I began to weep. So the rest of the group went. I didn't go towards the wall until the next morning. I'm an early morning person. So I woke up in the morning, got a cab, and I went there about 4 or 5 in the morning. And then, of course, you know, it's very quiet. There's people that are there, the women on one side, men on the other side. And it was such an amazing, being a worship leader, musician, and everything, doing that in church all my life. I have enjoyed God's presence, right? In different churches and fellowships and everything, but this was different because this was Jerusalem. And I didn't think about that consciously. I wasn't saying to myself, oh, I'm going to go to Jerusalem and this is the type of experience it's going to be, right? I just knew, I was excited, but I had no idea what to expect. And that's one of the reasons why, for me, is overwhelming. I wept, and not overwhelming for those listening in a negative sense, right? It wasn't like it was an oppressive thing, but it was very difficult to describe. And it was during that time that God just really laid on my heart to come back to the States and start the work that I began to do with the Institute for Black Studies of Israel. That happened during that time. And I'll share this one little anecdote. At some point I'm praying, it was amazing to me. And it was just so comforting to me. The holy men that'll be there, right? I guess some could be rabbis, some of the Torah scholars are studying. One gentleman in particular, I get there to pray, and he says, welcome, welcome. Like, we didn't obviously know each other. He's welcome, welcome, go pray. And he asked me, clearly he wasn't Hebrew, or obviously he spoke Hebrew, but I think it seemed to be also an Eastern European language. I'm not really sure because I can tell some of the accent, right? And he asked me in his way, did I want a prayer book? And I said, sure. And he brought me one, but it was like in Portuguese. So he didn't realize. I said, oh, that's really nice gesture and everything. Just this really nice guy. And another gentleman who may have been a rabbi at some point, I like to walk when I pray. I'll go to the wall, but I'm just having a little space. And as I'm walking, Yael, I am, my hands are clasped like this, right? I'm just walking. And there's a gentleman who comes up to me very gently, right? This guy's praying, but he said, you know, when you pray, you shouldn't clasp your hands together like that. He said, the right hand represents grace, the left hand represents judgment, and they should never be mixed. Always place your right hand over your left. Just a really quick drash, right?
Yeah.
And I said, thank you, Rabbi. And he just went on. And that was what, 2012? So you're talking about 12 years ago, right? So it was a while ago. I'll never forget. It was things like that here he is. He doesn't know me. He knows that I'm praying, but there's something in him that says, okay, let me give him this advice, right? As he's praying, as he's crying out to God, let me share this with him, because he's doing something that if I share this with him, it'll only enhance what it is that he's doing. Mm-hmm. Things like that kept happening during that time, Yaya, where people I didn't know, they would share something, they would give something. So it was just kind of underscoring what God was doing in that moment.
That's incredible. And that's so Israel, that everyone gives their advice. Try walking around with babies in Israel. I remember when I had my little baby in Jerusalem, my first baby, and I'd be walking through the marketplace and one grandmother would stop me and say, your baby's freezing cold, and put a hat on the baby. 2 steps later, another old grandma would come and say, your baby's too hot, take off the hat. And then everyone has their opinion, but it comes from this place of really having love for one another. That what I hear in that story that you're sharing is how you felt the love and care of this rabbi who says, let me try to make his prayer even more effective. Let me try not to, maybe he doesn't realize if he's blocking some sort of blessings that could be coming down. Let me try to direct him that he could receive those blessings. Yes, and it comes from a place of really really loving you and loving one another. And it's definitely very accurate after living here for 20 years of what I've experienced for 20 years. And the example I always give is when there's a terror attack, you don't see people running away from the terror attack. You see them running towards the terror attack in order to help others. And for me, that summarizes everything from the little things in life, like what you're saying, let me help you pray a little bit better, to maybe your baby's a little bit cold, put on a hat, to the big things of I will put myself in danger in order to protect others, which is so beautiful. You, as a young man, Pastor Washington, were also very inspired by the Aliyah of the Jewish people from Ethiopia. I was in Gondar not too long ago. I've been to Ethiopia more times than I can count in order to stand with and help the Jewish people from Ethiopia come home to Israel. The fellowship, of course, sponsors their Aliyah and resettlement in Israel. And I remember each time being on an airplane with the Ethiopian Jews, bringing them home to Israel. Tradition holds that they're from the lost tribe of Dan. I remember hearing one time someone who said to me, this is the only time that Blacks are taken out of Africa for freedom, to a better life, not a worse life, not as slaves, not forced, but in freedom, their own choice to a better life. What does the Ethiopian Aliyah represent to you, besides the ingathering of the Jewish people and the lost tribe of Dan coming home, as a pastor who is focused and his life work is on Black Israel relations? What does Ethiopian Aliyah mean to you?
That story for me, Yael, has a personal connection because of the way I became aware. So again, though I loved Israel as a kid, you know, all things Israelite, all the time, I had no, as a child, I had no concept of the modern state of Israel, right? So all of my context was biblical Israel, right? I knew a couple of Jewish friends at school. I knew that there's a temple in my hometown of Stockton at that time, but I never made any type of connection in that way, right? So I was totally unaware of everything from an Israeli-Palestinian conflict to Aliyah. It was in 1984, which was my senior year of high school, right? My senior year of high school was 84, 85. November of 1984, which was Operation Moses, right? Yeah. I didn't know any of this, right? So literally, the way God did it, I'm on my way out the door. My mom is watching the news, right? Probably ABC News with Peter Jennings, for those who listen. That's all a long time ago, right? There was no cable, right? There were three networks, ABC, NBC, CBS. And it was at the end of his broadcast. And he said, I can hear his voice finally tonight. And they do this kind of human interest story, right? Almost like a tail end of the newscast. Right. And he began to talk about Ethiopians who had come to Israel. I never even heard of anything like that before. And what I remembered the most was the picture. They're doing the B-roll as he's talking. Right. Okay. Two pictures I remember to this day. What was that, 40 years ago now, I think is? Yes. That was the 40th anniversary. Yep. This November will be the 40th anniversary, I think. There was a Ethiopian mom with her baby wrapped around her, like you would see in many African cultures, right? Yeah. And there was an Ethiopian elder who was on the ground, kissing the ground. Now, I didn't know what Ben Gurion Airport was. I could not have told you as a 17-year-old what I was looking at, but it was as if God grabbed my face and made me look at the screen, because I was literally on my way out the door. My friends were getting ready to go play basketball, baseball, whatever we're getting ready to go do. And I literally, he's like, I turned to the screen and boom, this is on. It doesn't make sense to me at the time. Of course, later on, right? Yeah. I go, okay, this is what you're doing. That was my first introduction to both Aliyah and to the Jews of Ethiopia, and in a broader sense, to the Jewish diaspora. Again, no concept of Jews from Europe and from Africa, from Asia, didn't have any concept of that, which is something of a tragedy, because again, for us as Christians, in terms of the roots of our faith, we should be aware of these things. And that's not a denigration from our pastors. I mean, you teach what you know, right? So, but when I saw that, I went, oh, okay, so that, among other things, lifts both, it's the pages of the Bible, and it lists what's going on in modern day, and they're connected, right? For those who say, oh, that's not the real Israel, that's not the Israel of the Bible. And they say that because they don't understand the very concept of many things, including the diaspora and the Aliyah. Yael, that was the beginning of that fascination for me. It was only several years later that I began to research Jews of Ethiopia, Jews of India, Jews of Germany, Jews of Poland. And it kind of, it blew me away, right? But here are these people who came from Israel, who over thousands of years and from all kinds of pogroms and all kinds of things, they have been scattered to the four corners of the earth, just like the Bible says God will gather them. So it's like, this is a physical, here is the Bible, right? Yael is the Bible. My friends from Ethiopia are the Bible. This is the Bible. So for me, it started in an unconscious way because I'm looking at these pictures. It's almost like my spirit knows that the pictures are important, but my brain has no idea. It's almost like God said, here, placeholder right here. I'll come back to this in a moment. Just remember this picture. And to this day, I still remember that telecast.
That is incredible. I remember hearing a story from Operation Moses where, you know, these Jews who are from the lost tribe of Dan, they were living in the mountains of Gondar, Ethiopia, totally disconnected from the world. I was there. I saw the huts they lived in and how you had to walk on foot to get to the top of the mountain, how disconnected from society they were. And I remember hearing a story that when they got to Israel, they've been studying God's word, Baal Peh, they say, giving it over generation to generation from the time that they were dispersed from Jerusalem and exiled from Jerusalem when the temple was destroyed. And so they knew the verses that they would come back to Israel and the third temple would be rebuilt. And when they landed in Israel, one of the women in Amharic, but there was someone who was able to give it over there, said, bring us to the temple, bring us to the temple. And there was a soldier there who said, the temple was destroyed. It hasn't been rebuilt. 2,000 years ago, it was destroyed. It hasn't been rebuilt. And they all started wailing and crying and tearing their clothes that they weren't coming home to the temple in Jerusalem. And that story for me gives the beginning, the middle, and the end. The beginning is that the temple was destroyed, that the tribes were exiled. The middle is what we're seeing now, that the words of the prophets are coming alive. And the end is, if this is happening, if this totally unfathomable reality that you never could have, I think about my grandfather in Germany during the Nazis and reading the scriptures and saying, one day you'll go home to Israel. What Israel? These are Nazis. 70% of them identify as Christian. What? And that now one generation later, two generation later, his grandkids, great grandkids who are in Israel, that as we say in Hebrew, Yeshua Tashem Kerafayin, redemption from the Lord comes in the blink of an eye. And when I hear your story of just being out to play basketball with your friends, and all of a sudden, in a second, God's opening up your eyes to his reality, his words, his prophecy that's possible, and then exploring it later and bringing you to this moment, God has such a plan, and we all have to believe that that plan on our life is happening, and it will happen.
I was reminded as you're talking, there's that, once again, in that Black American tradition, there's this fascination with the Ethiopian Jews and the Ethiopian community, right? There's the churches that were named up, the Abyssinian Baptist Church, Abyssinia, once again, Ethiopia. Right. There's this fascination with the Queen of Sheba. I consider myself someone who tries to be aware of history. And it was only about a couple of years ago that I learned in American history that during the time of the Italian invasion of Ethiopia, under Mussolini, that there was such a visceral reaction to that within the Black American community that there were Black men in Harlem and in Chicago who they were recruiting, they were signing up. This is a separate group, right? Who were signing up to go help Ethiopia fight in its war against fascist Italy. I didn't even know about this part of the story until a couple of years ago. And one gentleman, it got the State Department, of course, the government was kind of shutting that down, right? They didn't want them to do that, right? There's one particular gentleman, and his name is escaping me for those who are looking. If you just Google what I'm saying, so you'll probably find it. It's escaping right now. He actually did go. This was during the reign of Haile Selassie. And he went to go and help train Ethiopian pilots to be able to fight against Italy. The program didn't do well. It really struggled. There were a lot of things that hampered it. But he comes back to the States. He becomes one of the main architects of the Tuskegee Airmen. He comes back and helps other Black men and parts of the government establish what became the training for Black pilots in World War too. So this was a connection to the whole Ethiopian. These are things that I just learned a couple of years ago. So that story, there's been a fascination with the Ethiopian, both Aliyah, with the Ethiopian Jewish community, and with the Ethiopian Coptic Christian community in the Black American tradition.
Amazing. So this brings me, we don't have much time left, and I'm going to have you back because I want to talk to you for another hour, 2 hours, Pastor Washington. But I'm going to link in the show notes your book, Zionism in the Black Church, which was printed in its second edition in 2021 and deals in depth with so many issues that we are just touching on here. So I really encourage everyone to check that out, Zionism and the Black Church. And Pastor Washington, before we go, I'm going to go back. There's a Hebrew verse, Sof Maaseh Machshava Trila. The end result is reflective of the first thought. And you started off by saying how your mother and father inspired you so much by taking these Black figures in America and using them as an example of what you could accomplish, of what you could be, taking this very, very challenging, oppressive, hard history, and while teaching that part of it, also using it to encourage, inspire, and strengthen you. So I want to know, Pastor Washington, who is someone that you look up to, who has inspired you in life, and who has brought you to where you are today? It could be a biblical, a modern, or any other figure.
That sound corny. It would probably be my parents. It would be, again, they both passed away. It's so funny. My mom in 2002, my dad 2012, exact same date on the Gregorian calendar, but in the High Holy Days, one was the beginning of before the days of all, one was at the, it was this whole other story. We'll talk about that another time. I didn't see that till retrospect as well. But yes, for them as parents, the older I get, them as well as their siblings, my aunt, my mom's oldest sister, who was also my godmother, I probably reflect on them and what they did. Her husband fought in the Korean War. He's the first one who came out from Arkansas, and he built his life in San Francisco, and that all of that, right? So I stood on their shoulders, not even knowing it at the time. But yes, my heroes, if you will, would be those, maybe my parents and my aunts and uncles, who went through all that they went through, but built lives for us, seven of my siblings. I mean, it's seven of us, seven of my cousins. There's 14 of us as cousins would be running around all together, but we enjoyed the fruit of their labor and what they had gone through and what they built for us. So that it would be them, it would be my parents.
It's so beautiful. And just hearing a little bit about them, how they introduced the scriptures to you, how they gave you the freedom to explore on your own, how they taught, preached, and lived love and faith and raised you in the church from a place of feeling accepted and appreciated and seen. I can't think of any better role model. So Pastor Dumisani Washington, thank you so much for joining me on my podcast today. I encourage everyone to follow you on social media. How else could they find you?
They can go to ibsi.org, which is our organization, Institute for Black Solidarity with Israel. And we just separately launched a new radio show called Truth to Power. Live. So they can go to ttplive.com and find out more about that too.
Incredible. Thank you so much for joining me.